hopefully understand in an objective light, and then we'll open our forum up for individuals to offer their thoughts, challenges, questions, or their own statements. I'll be joined today by Paul Dorenzo. Paul Dorenzo has been an award-winning reporter, investigator, news director, and journalist within Pacifica for 20 years, and has held various positions, mainly at WBAI in New York. Some of the information I'll be giving is specifically events that occurred at WBAI, but at the same time reflect a larger issue of what's occurring with the ongoing struggles of people who believe and generally believe in such a way that they are would be considered true believers in their particular cause. All I ask is for people to withhold their judgments until they've heard various points. In my this March 25 years on Pacifica, doing a daily show, missing only 5 days in 25 years, I have originated more than 267 original in-depth investigative reports, such as pathologizing African Americans and toxic teeth and AIDS, a second opinion. Those are some of the more recent ones. But going clear back, the first programs done in the United States on the dangers of DDT, also an in-depth look at dioxin, Agent Orange, 245T, and its impact upon the service personnel serving in Vietnam, and for the last 11 years, fighting on behalf of the Gulf War veterans who have been suffering now more than 225,000 with illnesses they feel are related to their exposures to various contaminants during the Gulf War. All of these investigations are similar in some respects. They start off going in the face of everything that we were taught is true, where everyone has absolute certainties, no different than the certainties we have now about what side we should be on, who is right, who is wrong, and whose facts are correct. Along the way, early on, I was told by a person that I had accessed to be very careful about sharing my feelings at meetings inside of WBAI because there were FBI plants there. And I thought to myself, how will I know who's a plant and who's not? No one's going to acknowledge it. No one's going to say I'm here because this organization is considered a threat to government agencies. Well, it turned out that not only was that person correct, but in later documents that were released through the Freedom of Information Act and before Senator Church's hearings, that the CIA also had infiltrators within the alternative movement. In fact, they had over 1,600 journalists planted in various news organizations. Now, these were not just listening post positions, people who would retrieve information and feed it back. We would later learn that they were also there for disinformation, for causing internal conflict, turning people against each other who might otherwise find some common identity and a common front. So infiltrating the enemy as they saw it and causing confusion, consternation, conflict, and ultimately weakening them. There was no apologies as such from the news agencies, most of the news agencies, nor did anything ever happen to the people who at one time had shared their mics and shared the rooms and had been right there at the rallies and the secret meetings and the planning sessions against the Vietnam War, against the corruption in federal agencies. No, it was as if this, okay, it happened, there was nothing we could do, and go on with it. I give you that as an insight because The assumption was that after that earlier exposure, the government agencies ceased doing that, that all further communications, all further relevant contacts with any dissident radio station, which Pacifica certainly has represented a dissident voice in a form opposite that of the mainstream, that it would have been hands-off. How do we know? What will we find out in years to come, which is becoming more and more difficult to find out with the new challenge to the Freedom of Information Act and with the new Homeland Security Act? How do we know who is sharing their own view of what they like or don't like, or they're really to share the view of a particular agency in a disinformation campaign? I think it would be extremely naive to assume that all that's been happening within Pacifica and its various conflicts is purely and completely a hands-off government individuals. But that said, it's only in hindsight that we realize what was right or what was wrong about our position. Let me give you another point of view here. Let's go to a meeting at New York University. This is back in 1986. There were six individuals, six physicians and myself. I was invited by the medical school to put forward the challenge position. My challenge was that AZT and other drugs that were being offered to persons diagnosed with AIDS were at a far too high potency. There were no studies that the AZT study had, that the FDA oversaw, was flawed and was never complete. It was stopped short supposedly because of the AIDS dissidents, and ACT UP in specific were demanding that the drugs be allowed immediately and without further debate on the issue. And because of political pressure, everyone acquiesced and said, well, I guess in this case is correct. We have a very serious situation. We have people dying. We want to put time on their side. And that became the slogan, time on their side. So taking AZT. In fact, people were taking it every 4 hours, even waking up in the middle of the night to take their drug. Going around the country, visiting thousands, over 5,000 people I interviewed who were diagnosed as persons with AIDS, I noticed that the more diligent, the more regimen they were with their medical protocols, the sicker they were becoming. So I was merely, in effect, raising a single voice that why should we be looking exclusively at this approach? Why not look what happens when we build up the immune system naturally? This was dismissed out of hand. I was booed. In fact, at that particular lecture, I was given the least time of anyone. But I remember very clearly, and there's a tape of it, saying, but what if you're wrong? The room was packed. And I said, what if what we're calling AIDS is more than just an HIV virus? Now, at the time, I did not have any reason to believe that HIV did not exist. In fact, I was of the belief at that time that they indeed had isolated the virus, but I didn't believe that it was the exclusive cause of AIDS. Instead, I believed that, based upon my own research, that these were people who were getting sick because their lifestyle so depressed their immune system that it allowed this HIV virus then to decimate their health. Because I'd been working with a group through a Dr. Stephen Chiesa, a gay physician in New York who specialized in treating people with AIDS. And Chiesa was the belief that these men were succumbing in no small matter because they had advanced tertiary symptoms from syphilis. And that by giving him an aqueole, or water-based specific type of antibiotic, in a form of penicillin which could bypass the blood-brain barrier, they were able to kill off these spirochetes and at least keep these people from going further, then a whole nutritional program that I had devised were getting these people back their health. And I would meet with these people with health support groups weekly. So every week I was able to see people who were getting better. And in fact, their blood workup clearly showed that. So it wasn't a theory. It was fact. People who were doing something natural and non-toxic and only taking the antibiotics and some of the medications for the opportunistic infections, but 95% of their regimen was a natural regimen. I was not allowed to present this information. I sought out various venues, and one person invited me who sat on the board of the Men and Women's Gay Health Collective, and invited me to offer these opinions, and I went down to the village to offer them. I brought all my documents, and in fact, I brought 10 individuals from the support group who had all been in the program for more than a year, and one man had just made a complete, total reversal, a remarkable recovery. In fact, he had been one of the founders of ACT UP. I began to speak, and within 5 minutes, the boos, the hissing, the condemnation, the death threats, and I stood there, and I waited and waited, and it was clear that they weren't going to provide me an opportunity to share my information. So I said, if any of you want this information in the future, I'm happy to share it with you. Here's my office address on 72nd and Broadway. And the people I'm working with, I work free to help them. No one's charged a penny, because a lot of the people were complaining because they were poor and they couldn't get the drugs. And then one of the people from ACT UP got up to say, I was in St. Vincent's Hospital. I was near death. I had endocarditis. I've had encephalitis. I had thrush so bad I couldn't open my mouth. I'd be dead today, but I'm alive. Listen to what the man has to say. He saved my life and he saved others' lives. And I've been at the health support group meetings every week and I see it. We have not been given the full picture. Well, they greeted him by throwing a pop bottle against his head and fighting him. And I mean a big fight broke out. So I left. And that was the openness to new ideas. I've seen a lot worse in the way of fighting in all the different movements I've been in. I wasn't angry about it. I was just disappointed. The people were so certain in the rightness of their position that no information and no facts were going to change their mind. But on one level, it was an important lesson for me that once people made up their mind about something, for most people, it's almost impossible for them to acknowledge that what they have been believing is wrong. That's one of the reasons that we find it so difficult to look at something objective and fair-minded and open once we have committed ourselves to it, because our ego's committed, our self-esteem's committed. It'd be no different than asking your average physician, will you use vitamin C in helping post-surgical patients limit infections? Would you use intravenous ozone that they use in Germany to help save the 104,000 lives that are going to die this year of infections in the hospital? The overwhelming answer is no. Would you use homeopathy that has over 160 peer-reviewed published articles in double-blind randomized placebo-controlled studies showing that it works and it's non-toxic? Again, the answer is no. Would you take the mercury out of someone's mouth, the silver fillings, and replace it with biocompatible materials if you were given a holistic protocol and shown papers on why to do it? The answer is no. You could ask a psychiatrist, would you look at a person as a whole person and possibly their so-called mental illness is not mentally ill at all, but merely false symptoms due to an underactive thyroid or a cytotoxic reaction to the brain, or the overstimulation of serotonin rather than the utilization of serotonin from selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors? Would you look at rebalancing it naturally? And the answer is no. And you could ask the mediators, in the Middle East. Would you look at, and then it's no. Everywhere you look, everybody is so certain about their position. And most conflicts, most fights occur when people give no leeway to surrendering their position, because to do so is to acknowledge they may have made some serious judgment errors, which could have caused other people problems. After all, what's the American Dental Association going to do if people decide to sue them? What would your doctor do if it were shown that AIDS was in no small measure due to the drugs that people are using to treat it? They could be held legally liable. Well, what it shows me is that there is a strong historical precedent that people frequently don't want the real truth. It could scare them. After all, in the world we live in, it is not objectivity that we seek, but certainty. We seek the confidence of individuals who are our leaders, the leaders of different groups, and we follow them. No different than when Herbert Shelton, the chiropractor turned health guru in San Antonio, Texas, would bring people down to his home in San Antonio and fast them until their disease was healed. The problem was much of their disease was not healed, and they died. Even after he was convicted of manslaughter and forced to stop it, people still swore by the rightness of his methods. The trouble was they weren't. And of course, that's why I never talk about sex, politics, or religion as such on my program, because all you're going to do is alienate people who otherwise would find information possibly beneficial as long as they did not have completely strong views on it. And health is not something we have had strong views on. It's kind of been back there in the background of our mind. As long as we kind of weren't obviously sick, then we should be obviously healthy. As long as we kind of do some right things, it mitigates the wrong things. If we should get sick, we've got the best care that medicine can create. And we're living longer and healthier than ever before. Well, the trouble is all those are lies. But then to challenge the truth means you're putting tens of millions of people on the spot. I give you that just as background, because there is nothing less than that same confrontation when it comes to understanding some of the problems that we face. Let me go to my specific issues, and then we will try to relate these to what is happening at KPFK. I was asked by literally thousands of my radio audience in New York if I would take a look at what was going on behind the coup and the takeover of Pacifica by a self-selecting group of people who represented the Corporation for Public Broadcasting special interest, whose primary goal was to wrestle control of any really progressive programs and management, put in their own kind of puppet regimes, and that anyone who really stood for freedom, like Amy Goodman, or Juan Gonzalez, or Bernard White, or Valerie Van Isser, that was just at BAI, and at other stations around the country, that they should be purged. And so I began the process. And I was out of the city on tour, on a PBS tour, when the first phone call came in. And the phone call was from a person at BAI who said that, well, there's been a coup, massive firings, purges. The station has been, for all intents and purposes, taken over, and everyone is just being let go right and left. They have succeeded. And I said, who succeeded? Who specifically has been fired? And I was told, everyone. And it's just, it's chaos. You know, what we all feared has happened. So I asked them to be very specific. It's almost like hearing that there's been a car wreck, someone you know is in it, and they're yelling over the telephone. I ask them, try to take a breath, take a moment, get calm enough so they could explain in detail, because I'm a person that works from facts. And almost always, like 100% of the time, what I find are those facts are never what we're told. And we also have to understand that when it comes to Pacifica and its five stations, these facts change year to year, decade to decade. I never knew that a leading member of the American Communist Party ran Pacifica as president of its board for a long period of time. Quite frankly, it is immaterial to me, but I didn't know that because of my 25 years of trying to seek some changes at WBAI and PFW in Washington, I had written over 100 letters to members of the board. I never received one single response. In point of fact, I had written over 165 letters to the management of BAI. I received a few phone calls, never any detailed response. Nothing ever changed. So I was kind of the mindset, well, how do we know this is just not another internal struggle, of which there have been a lot? Now, a little background. It's always different when you look back on something and put it in perspective than when you're in the midst of something and try to put it in perspective, because you don't know where it's going. You don't know what its conclusion is going to be. And it's never the same when you're looking at someone in a coffin who's died, who you've been familiar with or a loved one, versus when you were trying to get them to stop smoking or drinking and they chose not to, or they were taking the wrong treatments and you're in that conflict. It's always different because now you see the outcome, or possibly when they gave it all up and were successful in whatever treatment they chose, and now the person can look back and you ask a question, what did you learn from your experience? There was a time when I was on BAI at the beginning when the station was run by a small clique. That particular clique, one of the very first cliques, was a radical gay clique. Radical gay in the concept that virtually as much programming as they could get were gay programming, and not the kind that, so what if someone's gay? What difference does that make? That's really irrelevant. Their sexual preference or their particular philosophy towards themselves is their business. It's a different matter, however, when you believe that a radio station should have a gay sound. And there was a purge. Some of the best people in the history of WBAI, real scholars, real humanistic people, people whose programming was phenomenal, such as Lex Hickson, Eileen Sallist, people who, one woman who was a native New Yorker but who had been working in Boston was actually commuting each week to do her show at her own expense. And none of us were ever paid. In fact, the only people who were paid were the people who had kind of taken over the airwaves. They controlled programming, they controlled management, with the exception of one manager. And when I spoke with that manager and I said, look at all the good shows that are going off the air. The station's unlistenable, with the exception of maybe 8 or 9 shows, Larry Josephson, some other shows. You can't listen to it. It's just bad radio. And this station manager said to me, Gary, there's nothing I can do. These people just don't talk with you. They scream at you, and they're physical. Indeed, I saw physical altercations all the time. One person even brought their motorcycle bike into the studio and would rev it up outside the door while the people were on the air. They thought that was cool. It wasn't cool. It was a disregard for the larger issue of what the station should mean. It completely flew in the face of Lou Hill, the founder of Pacifica's ideals. It was radio anarchy. When they finally left the air, then it became another clique And this time it was a kind of a very antisocial group. The trouble is they didn't serve any specific larger community that had been underserved. They were angry people, and they used the forum as their own particular soapbox. One man in particular, who was kind of their ringleader, was famous in New York for being a rabid anti-Semite. He would make statements that I haven't heard anyone being that bad in recent years doing. And he hated Jews. Didn't matter that you were pro-Zionist or Reformed or liberal. He hated all Jews. And he didn't hold back, and the people he had put on the air were the same mindset. A group of rabbis met with me, and they said, "We can no longer support your show, Gary." And I said, "Why?" And I remember at the time using this analogy. "Do you ever read the New York Times?" "Yes." "Well, there's a lot of things in there I don't like, and articles or columnists. I won't read Jane Brody. I don't like her. The stories, because they are pro-industry." And I gave examples. I said, "But don't stop reading articles you do like. Don't stop supporting a station because of ones you don't like." "No, because when we give our funds to support this station, we're giving them to people who are using the airwaves to support a hate campaign against us. We have asked to be on the show, we've asked to give a response, and we've been denied that. They talk about free speech radio. Well, it's not free because we're paying for it. And how much common sense is it when you pay someone to attack you, who hates you, who doesn't want to give you a form to respond to anything that's been said?" And so the funds started drying up. It got so bad that they'd turn off the phones, or they were turning off electricity. They couldn't pay bills. There was no maintenance. And I'd be asked, "Could I bring down a check to pay for the electric, just to keep the electric on?" And when I would try to broach the idea with some of the reasonable people, and there were some good, good people there, Rick Harris in particular, who was arts director and sometimes kind of program director, and he would say, "Look what I'm dealing with." And I remember in his office he had just a broken chair. He had no furniture, because it was also a time when virtually everything that could be stolen from the station was. In fact, I went down one Saturday. I normally wasn't on the air on Saturdays, Monday through Friday. And a guy at the elevator wasn't going to let me up in the building. The Brigadier building was closed. You had to go around the service elevator. And I said, "Why not?" And he said, "Because, you know, you haven't been invited up." And I said, "But I work here. I work at the station." He said, "I know who you are, but you're not getting up." Well, I had a friend with me. And my friend was in law enforcement, and he was just coming along I went down there and got some stuff. So he said, "You know, unless you have a legal reason to exclude this person from the building, I suggest you." And so we got on the elevator. Well, when we got off the elevator, then I knew why I wasn't allowed up. It was being used as the crime central. Proliferation of drug dealing. In fact, one of the leading people at the station was the chief of all this. He was using one of the central studios. I had donated to the independent producers at the station a DAT, which at that time was around $1,100. It's a recording machine, because they just didn't have one. It was hard to go out and do a story if you didn't have a tape recorder. And I donated it about 2 weeks earlier. And here is a guy walking out with my DAT that I'd given the station. And I asked the guy, I stopped him. I said, "What are you doing?" He says, I bought this." I said, "How much you pay for it?" He says, $25. I said, "Well, I'll give you $35. So I bought back my DAT, went inside, and there were people just buying whatever they wanted for nothing, doing drugs all over the place, and there was nothing ever that wasn't stolen out of the station. I was surprised at this, and also that day I was threatened by the person who was kind of in charge of it. On Monday, I met with the station manager, and I brought this to their attention. I didn't like the idea that we had no usable equipment. The station was an absolute cesspool. It was a crime scene. And out of my friendship with this guy, he didn't do anything that day. He could have made arrests and closed the whole station down. We could have lost our license. That simple. License over BAI no longer would exist. I pleaded with him not to do anything. That I believed all problems could be solved in a different way. He didn't do anything. That day he looked the other way. But nothing changed. It only got worse. In time, even those people were forced out by other people. In 20, almost 5 years of being at BAI every day, there's always been cliques who've been in control, as there are today. There's always a small power group, and they always have their own agenda. I cannot speak for other stations. I can only speak for BAI from my first-hand experience. Now, those are facts that are irrefutable, because as a journalist, I make sure I get proof and reference points wherever necessary. And a lot of other people have also witnessed this on their own term there. So we like to think that all this is behind us. We keep hearing people talk about Pacifica, you know. Well, we may be a dysfunctional family, but at least we're family. No, we're not. Well, we're there to help freedom. No, we're not. We're the only place where you can get uncensored radio. Have you ever heard that during fundraising? Support Pacifica because we're giving you the information without the censorship. Not true. Let me give you a scary little fact. I have never been off commercial radio. ABC, 12 years. WEVD, 12 years. WMCA, 2 years. And now in the last year, WNEW, 1 year. I've been on commercial radio longer than non-commercial radio by 3 years, and I have never been censored. No program director, station manager, advertising director has ever told me what I could and could not say, even when they were getting criticism from their sponsors. In fact, Mark Mason, the program director of ABC, formerly of MCA in New York, told me of the pressures he was getting from the sugar industry people when I would do a series of exposés on ABC. And I was the only one doing these exposés in New York City. I was the only investigative health show in New York City on any station for over 20 years. And I would go after people and organizations and concepts regularly. And I was never told, pull back on that, Gary. But I have been censored on BAI. In fact, I've been threatened. I will not at this time play the tape that I secretly tape recorded the Star Chamber meeting because it would disillusion people on one of their favorite superstars who everybody worships. But I got a whole different image on this person, being told I will never be able to do any program dealing with certain topics unless it's clear with them because that's their terrain. I said, no, that's not going to happen. But sitting in that room were station manager, program director, several other people, because in some way they felt threatened that maybe I had stepped over my health and nutrition area by having on someone who had a conservative point of view. And they didn't like that. They didn't want anyone with that conservative point of view on the air at all. And I commented to them, why should you be concerned about who I have on when the person I had on was talking about the unsafe skies and the dangers of the deregulation of the air because of what is happening to our safety in the process? And the fact this person had a conservative background, he wasn't there to talk about his conservative background, didn't bring it up. But I have a right to have anyone on from any political background, ideological background, or religious background, as long as what they're there to talk about is something that's germane to the audience. Now, show me anything that was wrong with the statements they made. show me any inaccuracies in their statements about airline safety. Well, that wasn't the issue. The issue was they were conservative. So, are you saying that Pacifica doesn't want to have conservative points of view on? It's only for the left? So I decided to go out and start researching, and I did. And this is 1996, by the way, September 8th, 1996. And I researched everything on the history of Pacifica, and at no point were any of the people involved in the creation of Pacifica stating, mandating, or insisting that only liberal points of view be shared on the airwaves. But that would be one of the very first casualties. In fact, repeatedly, I have been censored. My freedom of speech interrupted. My shows actually stopped. Not even allowed to broadcast because of program directors. Never ever happening anywhere else. Where people would actually hear me talking and suddenly, boom, my microphone went dead. So that a program director would not have my thoughts coming across what he considered his personal airwaves. Always different. Now, to the task at hand, give you that as a little background. There's a lot more that I can share, but that will be saved for later. So here I am, just doing my show. In 25 years, I was never asked my opinion by anyone at Pacifica. Not at any station in management. No station manager had ever spoken with me outside of BAI. And then it was not pleasant communication. So I had no friends within Pacifica. Outside of Samori Marksman, never once was invited to a single meeting. I was considered something of a threat. I was a threat because I had a large audience, the largest audience in the history of Pacifica, and I had raised the most money. I never received a penny. Never received any thank you. It was kind of like, we'll tolerate Gary because he keeps money coming to us. We won't pay him anything. And I was as poor as a church mouse. I had to have two jobs, but continue doing my broadcast. Somehow people would always assume because you're successful, you also have to be rich and that you don't deserve any consideration. Well, that wasn't true. I wasn't given any consideration, not even an electric bill paid, not even a phone bill paid. But my money was going to pay that anti-Semite salary. Yes, he was paid a salary. My audience wasn't listening to the rest of the station because it was unlistenable. But they were supporting other people who were paid to attack them, hearing them demeaned. Kind of this contradiction. But it was something I just tolerated. Now, let's jump forward. Pacifica has an unusual mission for a radio network. The Pacifica Foundation was founded to provide a voice for the voiceless, a forum for debating the world's great issues, and as an outlet for stimulating intellectual content not heard anywhere else on radio. Unlike most commercial stations, Pacifica was not meant to attract sponsors. Intellectual pacifist Lewis Hill spearheaded the creation of Pacifica based upon the idea that news and other programming should be derived from varied sources, not commonly used by other radio stations. The goal, Hill felt, was to present a broad spectrum of different opinions and views and cultural offerings, irrespective of a person's political, religious background. The Pacifica Board historically shied away from confrontation with many of its artistic staffers. I was not the first person or the only person to find that the various regimes over the decades did not communicate well with people at the local stations. Today, there are five stations as part of the Pacifica legacy. KPFA in Berkeley, KPFK in Los Angeles, WBAI in New York, KPFT in Houston, and PFW in Washington, D.C. Pacifica's first station was KPFA in Berkeley, where for many years the foundation was headquartered. In the last several years, it's been in Washington, D.C. Although each station has its own local advisory board or lab, the original vision was that Pacifica should be run in a top-down fashion by its national board. The national board was at first, then for years, comprised of people who managed KPFA in Berkeley, which was then the only station. And because, according to their own written statements, and by the way, I spent time in San Francisco, I've reviewed all of Lou Hill, the founder's, writings, I've listened to his archival tapes, because I didn't want someone telling me what Lou Hill represented. I wanted to hear for myself, because more often than not, it's in the interpretation that our perception is created. And if you give the wrong interpretation, then your perception's wrong, and hence your sense of reality and your belief in certain facts are wrong. And my interpretation of Lou Hill, after listening to him and listening to his actual tapes and reading his actual writings, were completely different than his biographer's point of view. So Lou Hill didn't believe in absentee input. He felt that it was a source of misunderstanding and obstruction. So he designed the formation of Pacifica and KPFA to be one. That is, those who own the radio station were also the KPFA staff who actually broadcast and carried out its policies. Rather than a federation of collectives, founder Louis Hill saw the enterprise as a kind of co-op as it worked towards the enlightenment of all the listeners. Now, it's important to understand, Lou Hill did not believe that in order to be a bona fide certified listener to any station, that you had to be from a minority, that you had to be given ghetto programming, that you had to be part of a radical concept. That's not what he advocated. In fact, cultural programming, even in music and literature, were two of the biggest things he offered, because the average radio show did not have highly literate programming by intellectuals and scholars in the field that he would bring in to do these shows. And some of these early shows are very interesting, in not just in how they're broadcast, but the people who were doing the broadcasting. He believed that, remember again, the voice for the voiceless. The voiceless were those people, the masses, who were not getting a full spectrum. It didn't say a minority people, and once you become black or white, upper middle class, you no longer are a certified card-carrying activist member of a Pacifica station. That was not at all in any of the dialoguing writings or concept of Pacifica. When confronted recently by the current board, Leslie Kagan, about dishonoring Lou Hill's name, she said on my program in a debate with Bernard White and Valerie Venister, who debated me on this issue, she said, well, we have to do a new direction. Well, that's where a very important piece of this falls together. Now let me go back and give you some of the highlights. Now, I'll tell you why. I'll come back to that later, why that's so important about we have to take a new direction. Now, the allegations. Here are the allegations. In December 2000, I'm away from New York on tour, as I mentioned. I was told of the massive firings. That Valerie Venister, the longtime station manager, had been abruptly fired, that additional massive firings were going on all over the network, and that this was a coup, was the first step being handed down by the Corporation Public Broadcasting minions to their insiders, carried out by a group that wanted to take over Pacifica Foundation. My emails were flooded with demands to join the dissidents, fly back to New York immediately, and be outside the station, go on the air, and use my large and powerful audience to stop the coup with warnings. And this is the other side of it, that if I did not join them, I'd be thrown off the air by them. So here I'm being told that if I do not acquiesce and join the fight of the dissidents, that they will fight me. And this would not be the first time that I'd have these kind of threats. I had many questions, however. First, I asked who was behind the supposed coup. They couldn't be specific. They kind of gave me just names, but nothing that would give me a specific individuals as such. The allegations were that it was a group of multinational supporters, ultra-capitalist, and rabid right-wingers who had infiltrated Pacifica's national board and were trying to make the station sound like National Public Radio. Why? I asked. The answer was that the board members would then be in a position to sell the Pacifica stations, purge all of the leftists and all of the programs that represented a challenge to mainstream institutions. According to radio marketing experts, they were quoting, BAI and KPFA, both commercial licenses, could be worth between $80 to $150 million each. The dissonant story was that by changing the foundation's bylaws, the so-called manipulative supporters of the business elite would clear the way for station sales, from which, according to the dissonant, they would make a 10% commission. And during a series of investigative programs at the height of the conflict, I attempted to get to the root cause of this conflict and find a solution. I spoke with New York Daily News columnist Ron Gonzalez, who was also co-host of Democracy Now! Gonzalez had resigned from the program, anchored by long-term Pacifica producer Amy Goodman, to become one of the leaders of the dissidents. To help explain the genesis of the conflict, Gonzalez elaborated on the problem that some people saw with the foundation bylaws. He said, quote, I think what's happened in the past few years, unbeknownst to many of us who were not paying close attention, is that the board at Pacifica has instituted a series of changes, many of which are suspect as to whether they're even legally able to do that, unquote. Gonzalez went on to put his finger on what he claimed was the critical issue, quote, the decision to take away the power of the labs of the five stations to have a say in who would sit on the board, and then the decision of the board increasingly to prevent anyone who opposed that, either in the labs, in the staff, or among the listeners, to voice their concern over this policy direction, unquote. According to Gonzalez, the Pacifica National Board had, quote, set in motion movement toward dictatorship, a dictatorship very similar to many of the other for-profit corporations that many of us here in capitalist America have grown accustomed to having to deal with, but we never expected we'd have to deal with it that at Pacifica, unquote. Gonzalez announced that in reaction to the board, the dissidents had, quote, launched a campaign to end what we've called the corporate takeover at Pacifica, an attempt to ape corporate models of decision-making and top-down orders and policies at Pacifica, aping what has occurred in the rest of America and, unfortunately, what has occurred in the rest of the mass media. Unquote. Gonzalez explained why he was uneasy with members of the national board. Quote, I realize that many of the current people do not come from the progressive movement that made Pacifica what it is. They did not come out of mass struggles. They did not come out of major battles of civil rights movements or the movement for Puerto Rican liberation or the black liberation or environmental movement. They're basically like Clinton's new Democrats, technocrats, basically, who saw in Pacifica an underutilized resource that they could take in a direction that they envisioned as a part of their agenda, unquote. In Gonzalez's view, those board members, now gone, disdained the movement that gave rise to Pacifica. They have this attitude, he said, that the listeners of Pacifica, many of them are stuck back in the 1960s. They're stuck in the radical era of the past, unquote. A point of view that Gonzalez openly disdained. Gonzalez further claimed that the Pacifica National Board does, quote, not have a right to utilize illegal dictatorial means to impose their viewpoint on the rest of the staff or on the listeners and on communities that have long seen Pacifica as a beacon of dissent and progressive thought and culture in America, unquote. Juan Gonzalez played a key role, if not the leading role, as head of the dissidents' national organization called the Pacifica Campaign. Gonzalez is a founder of the 1960s radical group known as the Young Lords, which was based on the politics of the Black Panther Party. With the demise of the Young Lords in the 1970s, Gonzalez continued on to head the National Congress for Puerto Rican Rights, a more moderate group dedicated to voter registration. Born in Puerto Rico and brought up in New York City, Gonzalez graduated from Columbia University and has built a career in journalism. The winner of the 1998 George Polk Journalism Award and a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Hispanic Academy of Media Arts and Sciences, he's been a daily columnist for the Daily News since 1988. But Gonzalez seems to have allowed his experience and credibility to evaporate in his treatment of the Pacifica crisis. Gonzalez gave the progressive stamp to the dissidents, but never interviewed any members of the board's progressive faction. Instead, Gonzalez participated in the vilification of the progressives. Many of his statements regarding the dissidents and the movement were not supported by facts. One of the most disturbing events was when a dissident activist from former Pacifica employee launched a homophobic attack on Pacifica's national program director, Steve Yasko. Both Gonzalez and co-host Amy Goodman appeared to defend the attack on Yasko. Steve Yasko complained that he was the victim of a conspiracy meant to destroy him personally. He reported that a certain individual who was part of the Pacifica campaign directed this conspiracy. Yasko explained that to teach himself computer skills, he set up a small personal web homepage under the name of Alter Ego, character name Mike Bilk, that was dedicated to travel for the gay community. He was an openly gay individual. Yasko says part of an original version of his website was inadvertently left posted after he started a new version. Still posted on the old site was a page linked to a site called hillaryshair.com that was dedicated to critiquing changes in Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton's hairstyle. The Hillary Hair site had been reviewed in the news, and Yasko said it was an entertaining and cute but not malicious. Long after Yasko forgot about his original webpage, which was still partly up on a web server run by ISP, the domain name was trounced. That's a computer term when an abandoned webpage is surreptitiously taken over, usually by a pornography site. According to Yasko, and independently verified, all I'm telling you I've done independent verification on, that's what happened to hillaryshair.com, and he adds that when this individual associated with the Pacifica campaign found out that hillaryshair.com had become a porn site, they pounced on it. Later, ABC talk show host Lynn Samuels, a former BAI Pacifica producer, broadcast the trumped-up sex charges mentioning Yasko's name on ABC. Yasko responded there was, quote, no tangible reason to destroy my life. The only thing Amy Goodman was asked to do was behave and report to her supervisor. There was never anything we asked her not to do, unquote. Yasko claimed that the individual responsible for smearing him worked closely with Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. He added that they were actively looking to discredit him and that he discovered the quote, Amy and Juan wanted my resume to try and show I wasn't qualified, unquote, for a job with Pacifica. Yasko learned the depth of the campaign against him after he got a phone message from an agent who worked with for years urging him to, quote, get me your resume quick. There's a major market job opening for you. Yasko was skeptical but provided his agent with the information and left for business meeting in New York. That night, Yasko's cell phone started ringing. He said the caller was impersonating a member of the board of directors of the, quote, major market station that was supposedly interested in him. The caller said, quote, why did you come to New York to fire Amy Goodman, unquote. Yasko answered that the caller was wrong and that, quote, Amy is a treasured voice in Pacifica. There's no plans to fire Amy Goodman, unquote. Afterwards, his partner told him he had earlier fielded a call from the same person who had just called Yasko and had given him Yasko's cell phone number. Yasko said that his home telephone number was in his resume. The following day, according to Yasko, his resume and cell phone number were posted on the Internet by an individual from the Pacifica campaign who harassed him for days with what he described as lies and impersonations, unquote. Amy Goodman is a longtime broadcaster who moved on to WBAI as a reporter and then news director when she began hosting Democracy Now! In 1995. Goodman's name became national news on November 12, 1991, when she was present in East Timor during a massacre of Timorese independence demonstrators by Indonesian troops. The presence of American citizens got the shooting mentioned in news briefs by Bush Press spokesperson Richard Boucher. Goodman and her partner, reporter Ellen Nairn, later testified about the massacre before Congress, and both have become activists in the Timorese independence cause. Goodman's notoriety and reporting skills contributed to Pacifica's decision in 1995 to offer her the slot as a national program host. The program eventually became known as Democracy Now!, with its slogan, quote, "the exception to the rulers," unquote. Goodman eventually gave up her position on WBAI as news director, which she had held concurrently with her position as Democracy Now! Host. But she continued on as co-host of WBAI's local morning show called Wake Up Call, together with WBAI program director Bernard White. According to former Pacifica staffers, Goodman was paid a part-time salary by BAI to serve as Wake Up Call co-host, although she also received a full-time salary at the same time from Pacifica as host of Democracy Now!, a situation that caused a lot of people consternation. After all, with so many good qualified people wanting to be on the air, how was it that one woman held down two positions on BAI, and that was the exception, not the rule, and was paid for both when the vast majority of individuals on Pacifica, volunteer producers, again producing a lot of good program, were paid nothing? Well, there was concern about that. Goodman and her allies' vitriol towards Yasko has its roots in events that occurred in the late summer and fall of 2000. Yasko had been hired in August as national program director, making him Goodman's immediate supervisor. Within 3 months, Goodman and Yasko were at loggerheads. The result would be a filing of a formal grievance by Goodman, which included a complaint against Yasko for gender discrimination that was investigated by Pacifica and by AFTRA, which represented Goodman. Yasko gave a memo reprimand to Goodman with a list of work rules on October 16, 2000. Then Goodman responded with an email letter addressed to Pacifica Executive Director Bessie Walsh on October 18, 2000. Goodman states in her letter, quote, "Several of the new rules target me and are outright attempts to curtail my constitutional rights of free speech," unquote. Quote, "I have now filed grievance against Pacifica management, charging harassment, gender harassment, censorship, among other violations of the union contract," unquote. Copies Goodman's letter went on to the Internet beginning on October 19th. Goodman denies she made the letter public. On October 22nd, Pacifica posted their response to Goodman on the Pacifica Foundation website, and on October 1, New York attorney Michael Ratner, representing Goodman, wrote a letter suggesting, among other charges, quote, "certain of her supervisor at the Pacifica Foundation were engaged in a campaign of harassment abuse, and that person was Yasko," unquote. Goodman reveals in her letter of October 18th, in which she announces the filing of formal grievances, quote, "in fact, union officials dissuaded me 2 weeks ago before the meeting," at which time she says Yasko handed me the memo in the law office of her union after from filing a formal grievance against Yasko and Pacifica for harassment because they had been led to believe Pacifica wanted to resolve these conflicts amicably. Thus, the issuance of Yasko's memo appears to have been the catalyst that finally enabled Amy to file her formal grievance. Had Yasko been provoked into writing a disciplinary memo as part of a setup to launch the grievance and ignite the Pacifica battle campaign that was about to ensue, it is possible, based upon how quickly copies of Goodman's letter of October 18th to Bessie Walsh poured out onto the Internet, that Goodman and her supporters may have been looking for a fight. Yasko's disciplinary memo to Goodman had, in contrast, been kept confidential. It's also possible Goodman and her lawyer may have been disingenuous about the cause of the dispute because between Goodman and Pacifica, one of the problems was Pacifica's outrage over Goodman's inappropriate reporting from the Republican National Convention in Philadelphia in late July and early August 2000. On August 2, 2000, as Republican Vice President nominee Dick Cheney was accepting the nomination, Green Party candidate Ralph Nader, accompanied by Amy Goodman, entered the convention floor and gave an impromptu news conference. Former Pacifica staffers say that Goodman provided Pacifica press credentials to Nader, which they maintain caused the Republicans to pull all Pacifica press passes from the remainder of the convention. Goodman's attorney, Michael Ratner, speaking on behalf of Goodman, denies in his letter of November 1st to Pacifica that Goodman gave the press pass to Nader. It says, quote, Ralph Nader did go to the convention floor at the Republican convention, but this was not facilitated by the use of press credentials of either Amy Goodman or Democracy Now! Employees. Ralph Nader entered the convention at the invitation of MSNBC. Democracy Now! Arranged an interview with him in the hallways of the convention. He was soon surrounded by numerous journalists, and he walked onto the floor without the necessary floor pass and without being stopped by security, unquote. The Pacifica Foundation stand on this matter. In their press release of October 22nd, quote, a statement from the Pacifica Foundation on its award-winning Democracy Now! Is as follows in this section entitled Democracy Now! Created its own problems with respect to receiving press credentials. As has been widely reported, Democracy Now! Provided Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader a floor pass to Republican National Convention, which occurred a few weeks prior to the Democrat National Convention. The Democracy Now! Website, without Pacifica's knowledge, said the candidate had been, quote, smuggled onto the floor using a journalist pass, unquote. As a result, the Congressional Press Gallery, who issues conventional credentials, became concerned that members of Pacifica National Programming Unit covering the Democratic Convention would engage in similar events. The Nader incident put all the Pacifica in danger of not receiving credentials for the Democratic Convention and could even have jeopardized our congressional press credentials for use on Capitol Hill in the White House. A management decision was made in light of the Nader incident at the Republican National Convention to protect the Foundation's access to official press credentials by not providing credentials to the staff of Democracy Now! For the Democratic National Convention. According to Bessie Walsh, the person who was really the boss of Yasko, quote, Steve Yasko and Garland Ganter had to talk up a blue streak in order to stop the Democratic National Convention from banning all Pacifica reporters, including reporters from each station, from covering the convention that was held in Los Angeles later in August. Currently, Democracy Now! Website archives the broadcast of a tape of Nader's comments on the convention floor, including Goodman's introductory remarks delivered live prior to her playing the tape, with some grandstanding as follows, quote, well, folks, history was made last night at the Republican convention, and we're not talking about Dick Cheney's speech. It was what happened on the convention floor while he spoke. In what is believed to be the first time in U.S. history, a candidate for president held an impromptu but well-attended press briefing on the convention floor of an opposing party. We're talking about Ralph Nader. In fact, we had asked him to come to the convention. We wanted him to provide commentary analysis. The networks think nothing of bringing in opposition Democrats, but these political figures still invariably reinforce the official line. We brought in Ralph Nader as the voice of an outsider who's been excluded from the political process in many ways. From the moment he arrived, scores of bored reporters desperate for a story, as well as delegates and politicians, swarmed around Ralph Nader as we began our journey to the convention floor, unquote. What's clear, the Democracy Now! Archives, that Goodman was a strong supporter of Nader and had sacrificed her journalistic objectivity to become an advocate of the Green Party candidate. Anyhow, there's always another side to the story, but you wouldn't know there was that other side. You wouldn't know that every single journalist at every single station, including KPFK, could have been banned from any press official press gatherings, the Democratic National Convention, because of that kind of effort. Because only one side, Goodman's side, was up and being advocated. Now let's go back to my phone call. I had a phone call where I spoke directly with station manager Valerie Venisler. And I called her from out of town. Back in that December day, 2000, I said, what is happening? She said, well, they fired me. I said, who fired you? Specifically, who? Was an individual? How did it happen? Well, they did. I said, all right, do you have a number? I'll call them. I'll make a call on your behalf. I don't know they'll listen to me, but I'll do all I can to see that you're reinstated. She didn't know. So I didn't even know who to call. And then I started my investigation. Here is what actually happened. And I have supporting documentation for all the above. We were told there was a coup. We were also told that then there would be a counter coup. And the counter coup was to take back Pacifica. And it just picked up momentum. And there would be an enormous amount of individuals coming on board to help in the counter coup. Thousands of people. People who, many of them, had no history in broadcasting, no history with their local stations. They were just people who believed that the Pacifica was being taken over, hijacked by these corporate radical capitalists. And they would fight in whatever way they had to get it back. That is what we were told. But there was a problem. The problem was that that information was not correct. So I looked at each one of the allegations. And there was one person who was a close friend of mine, by the way, at the time, who said, Gary, you've got to come on our side. You've got to go on the radio. You've got to have me on the radio. And I said, why? And I was told that by having this person on the radio, that they would tell about the fact that the stations were for sale. They were trying to change the bylaws. They were going to make a commission out of it. They were purging every progressive station on the air. So I looked around and I started looking at all the progressive programming, and I didn't see that any had been purged on BAI or on PFW. And so I said, well, what proof do you have? Well, it's just common knowledge. I said, no, that doesn't buy it for me. Where's your proof? So they started to attack everybody who had been brought in to replace Valerie Van Isler, which was one woman, actually, and her name was Eutrice Lead. Eutrice had been an activist involved in civil rights movement, social movements, the women feminist movement, African-American woman, single woman, for over 20 years. And the letter that this person gave me, where he was financing the dissidents and financing the effort to take back Pacifica, started off describing who this new station manager was, interim station manager, Eutrice Lead. And he said that she was a corporate shill that was brought in to the Sun, which is a New York kind of radical paper, by its owners to unionize it and so it could be sold. So I sat down with Eutrice Lead, who I'd never met, never spoken with before. And I